Today's reading is from Mark. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already being swamped. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased, and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe, and they said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The word of God for the people of God.
Water symbolizes many things.
Water cleanses.
It restores.
Water gives life.
It is peaceful.
It is essential.
Water is powerful.
Where there is water, hope dwells.
With God, there is always something in the water.
Good morning. Allow me just a short word of introduction. My name is David Williams, and I'm the pastor of Worship and Family Ministries here at St. Luke's, and I'm not often in this service. I'm the guy that when you look at your bulletin, you see 9:30, David Williams, and that's me. Rob and I are switching this Sunday because it was his desire and my desire that we spend time with the congregations that each of us normally leads, and so I'm blessed and honored to be with you today. Let me ask a question. I want you to picture this in your head. Picture a family sitting in a waiting room at a hospital, maybe outside of an emergency department, and they're anxiously passing the time, kind of making chit-chat with one another, but they're clearly waiting, and in walks a doctor. What happens to their eyes? Where do they go? Or picture that you are at some kind of board meeting, and there's someone around the table who brings forward a report that is shocking. It contains news that is disturbing, bad, unexpected. It demands some kind of action or response, and there's a silence that follows. Where is everyone looking in that moment? Or think of a Final Four game, and your team had the game in control. It was done and over until the other team went on a 16-0 run. This happened last night. The coach called a timeout. And everyone comes to the sideline and they're jawing at each other, the players are, and they're hitting their head in frustration. But when they sit in that huddle, where do their eyes go? The answer is that our eyes and our attention always goes to the person in authority. Whether it's a doctor or a boss or a coach, we naturally, in a time or a moment of crisis or panic, we look to authority to recenter us. And it doesn't have to be someone in a position of authority, a doctor or a coach. I mean, think about after the doctor walks out of the waiting room. The same thing, the family's still waiting for one person, a member of the family, someone with informal authority and influence to be the first to speak. Or, after the players break the huddle, the coach is no longer the one, but there's some person on the team that says, "Come on, guys, we got this. I'll carry you. Hop on." We instinctively look to someone in authority, and this is hardwired into us. I mean, genetically, this isn't a choice that you and I get to make. It's just who we are. There are research about primate groups and how authority works in primate groups. Ron Heifetz, in his book Leadership Without Easy Answers, he describes groups of gorillas in Central Africa in the lush mountain forest there, and they travel in tribes, packs of about 12 to 18, but at the center of that tribe or band, there is always one silverback male gorilla who is the alpha. And every other gorilla, researchers have studied this, they tend to orient themselves around that central male, and they look his way more than they look at each other. Why do they look at him? Because they take their cues from their leader. When he eats, they eat. When he rests, they rest. When he moves, they move. And when he beats his chest and lets out a big Tarzan yell, which I'm not going to do, I don't have that kind of voice, but when he does that, they instantly move into defensive formation behind him because he's alerted them there's a threat that's coming. We behave the same way, we humans. We're kind of hardwired. It starts even in early childhood. That researchers have studied preschool classes, not just in America, but in different cultures, in Europe, in Asia, in Japan. I said Asia and Japan like they're different, but anyways, they've done this kind of study, and think about it, a preschool class, 12 to 15, about the same size as those gorilla groups, and they've studied this, and they say naturally, without any child being told or someone being anointed by the teacher, children naturally identify a dominant child in their midst. And the dominant, what that means is that child is the one who organizes games, or who settles disputes about toys and who gets to play with what. There tends to be a dominant child, and researchers have studied this, and they say that it's interesting because all the other children tend to orient themselves, what stations they go to, where they go, by that dominant child, and their eyes glance more at that child than at all the other peers. Ron Heifetz kind of looking at this phenomenon, he says, attention always goes up. We're looking up the hierarchy, and not just at the dominant child, of course, with children, and looking at teachers, at parents, adults, authority figures. Now, you may have a child that, doesn't pay attention very well. Like, you see in Disney World, like, some parents have to put the leash on their kids. They would do it as a backpack. But, you may have a wandering kid or a grandkid, but the truth is that children pay more attention to where we are then we pay attention to where they are. Because when there's a moment of crisis, something unexpected, something scary, the child instantly locates us, the authority, to protect them and make them safe. And this plays out in adulthood. In adulthood, we eventually reach the point where we aren't quite so central on one, central authority figure. But the reality is, if you take any single one of us and throw us in a new, uncomfortable environment where we don't know people, where our social structure is gone, we instinctively gravitate towards a authority figure to give us peace. Jamal and I experienced that very recently. We had the opportunity to take a group to South Africa about a month ago. And it was 37 people, mostly from St. Luke's. And so for the first half of the trip, or first two-thirds of the trip, Jamal and I were, in a way, the authority figures. Even though we didn't really know that much about South Africa, we'd never been there before, we'd read a lot of books. But because we were the pastors, and because we got to speak on the speaker sound system in the bus, people kind of looked to us and take their cues from us. We're kind of used to that. But then at the last third of the trip, we broke off from the group. The rest of the group went to a safari, and Jamal and I had time to spend with a man named Dr. Peter Story. Now, Dr. Story, there's a picture of Jamal and he. Dr. Story was a professor of ours at Duke Divinity School, a person that I can't help, I think of as an authority figure in my life. In fact, the whole time we were with him, he kept saying, Dave, call me Peter, call me Peter. And I couldn't get, he's still Dr. Story. He will always be Dr. Story to me. And Dr. Story was an amazing man. Is an amazing man. He was a leader in South Africa in the anti-apartheid movement, bishop of the South African Church, president of the South African Council of Churches. I don't have time to tell you all his exploits, but he was a huge influence on Jamal and us. He's the reason that we went to Haiti right out of seminary for the first 2 years of our marriage. It was because of this man, Dr. Story, and we had the opportunity to spend a few days with him. And Dr. Story lives right on the coast next to False Bay, and I didn't know this at the time. People have told me this since we got back. If you know anything about False Bay, if you watch Shark Week on Nat Geo, False Bay is home to like the greatest population of great white sharks. It's one of the few places in the earth where great white sharks breach, come to the surface. Dr. Story took us sailing, and I was so glad I did not know this about great white sharks. He told us afterwards that one time a great white shark came up beside his boat, and it was longer than the boat. I mean, so we are so glad we did not know this detail. But for Jamelyn and I, who had never been sailing before, the experience was, in a way, scary. And part of the fear was the wind. This was kind of a windy season in Cape Town on the south. Even though the sun was out and the weather was beautiful, they had a southeaster wind that was just brutal. 3 days after we went sailing with Dr. Story, there was a cycle tour, the Cape Town cycle tour, and it's 30,000 cyclists bike the 100 kilometers from Cape Town down to Cape Point and back up. It's a huge race. And they had to cancel it this year because this is what the weather looked like. Check out this video.
Come this way. Okay.
So you can see what the wind was like. Now, it wasn't like that when we went out on the water, thankfully, but it was fierce. I went running the day after that, or the day before that, and I mean, I was trying to run into the wind, and it was, I mean, I felt like I was just running in place. It was just pushing you back. So this morning, this particular morning, the wind did die down some, and Dr. Story took us out on the water, except the, I mean, it was still pretty strong, though. We didn't put up the mainsail. We just used the jib. And even that, after, you know, the first 15 minutes, he realized the wind was so strong, he reeled it into just half sail. And so the first time that the wind really hit us, you know, and filled the sail up, some of you probably just know this, but I didn't. That sailboat instantly went like a 45-degree angle. And I was sitting on the side that went down, you know? And thankfully, I did not know about the great sharks then, but I literally could have just reached behind me and my hand would have been in the water. And so when that boat tilted to that degree, where did our eyes instantly go? To Dr. Story. Because he's the authority, he's our anchor, he's our safety. And when we looked at him, what did we see? But his, you know, big smile on his face. His hand was on the tiller. He was in complete and total control. And so, what did Jamel and I do in that moment? We breathed. We relaxed. Jamelyn says a little bit. She was still a little nervous. But there was something about having an authority figure who knew what he was doing that put us at ease. And this small experience, I had it in my head when I was thinking about today's Bible story. Except these weren't, you know, landlubber novices like Jamelyn and I. These were experienced fishermen who went on the boat. And I'm sure the wind was a lot fiercer than what we experienced. It probably was something like what those cyclists experienced. I mean, the wind was fierce. The gospel writers used the most graphic language they can to describe it. In Matthew, when he describes the storm, he says it's like a seismos. That's the Greek word he used, an earthquake upon the water, upon the surface. Mark and Luke, they use this phrase, the waves beat into the boat, but that's kind of like the English dilutes it some. The Greek is more like the waves hurled themselves into the boat. And it wasn't just the size of the storm, it's suddenness. I mean, it's well documented, the mountains around the Sea of Galilee, when the winds sweep down those mountains onto the surface, storms appear immediately, suddenly, like you can leave thinking all is calm, and all of a sudden, with no forewarning, you're in the midst of a storm and you're fighting for your life. I mean, we don't have to linger too long on this metaphor, but there's storms in life, right? I mean, you can think of one. A time of darkness or difficulty that you've lived through, or for some of you that you might be experiencing right now. And I think the storms that are most scary to us are the ones that we have no warning, no preparation. They just come. We're released from a job, even though we thought we were doing great work. Someone ends a relationship with us, even though we desperately want to hold on and make it work. Or maybe, you know, we've been healthy and fit all the days of our lives, and then we've done everything right, and then all of a sudden an accident or diagnosis that we didn't see coming happens, and the storm hits. And the detail about that scripture that I liked, if we can put that back on the screen, was the boat was already being swamped. The boat. I mean, the boat, the thing that gives safety. The boat, the thing that gives security. In life, the boat isn't just one thing. It's lots of things. It's our career, our family, our friends. It's our well-being. It's our competence. It's our identity. But when a huge storm hits, the boat is under attack. It's swamped. And we feel like we're going to die and perish. And in that moment, where do our eyes go? For the disciples, their eyes went instantly to their leader. Even though Jesus wasn't an experienced fisherman or, you know, sailorman, even though he didn't have any technical knowledge to give them, he was their leader, and their eyes instinctively went there. And what did they see? Not Jesus calmly, you know, directing the boat, not Jesus giving them instructions or helping bail the water. Jesus was asleep at the front of the boat. And this doesn't inspire in them any sense of calm or peace. In fact, it does the opposite, because they think their leader is disconnected, apathetic to their concern and their worry. Even though he's in the boat with them, he doesn't share in their panic and anxiety. And so they wake him up and they say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, other gospels clean this up a little bit. Matthew and Luke, they were written after Mark, and they changed the language to, "Lord, save us, for we are perishing." But I like Mark's version, because I don't think the disciples knew that Jesus could save them. I mean, we know, you know, 2,000 years removed, that Jesus had this power, but they didn't. They didn't necessarily want Jesus to save them. They just wanted to know, "Jesus, do you not care?" I mean, you see, this is what panic and fear does. It can drive us to an authority figure, but if we don't think that authority figure is paying attention, then it drives a wedge between us. Think about communities across our country where people are suffering and hurting, and they're crying out to our leaders saying, "Do you not care? How can you just do business as usual? We're perishing down here." And sometimes we say that to God. When we're in a place where, despite all of our prayers, we can't discern an answer, a response, we say, "God, don't you care? Where are you?" And it's interesting how Jesus responds, because that's a natural gut response for us, "Don't you care?" But Jesus, when he responds, he doesn't respond by defending himself. Of course I care. He doesn't respond with tenderness. Of course I care. He doesn't do anything like that. Instead, he responds with rebuke, reprimand, a slap across the spirit, so to speak. Rebuke. Now, Jamel and I were talking about this, and she said, "You know, for me, it always reminded me of when I was overtired as a parent, and my kids came to me with some crisis that to them was the end of the world, and I was like, just quiet. Mommy needs her rest, and then I'll be compassionate afterwards," you know, like. But Jesus, he rebukes. And there's two rebukes that happen. The first rebuke is to the wind and the seas, and he says to them, "Peace, be still." Again, this is not a soft "peace, shh, 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 be calm, shh, shh, shh." It's a command, "Peace." The reason I know it's a command is because it parallels, you can see it there on the verse, Mark 1, on the screen behind me. Now, this is the very first in Mark 1, the first miracle that Jesus does in Mark's gospel. He goes into a synagogue, and there is a man there with an unclean spirit. And as soon as Jesus enters, the man with the unclean spirit begins crying out, "Jesus, Son of God, Son of Man, go away from me." And Jesus replies, and he rebukes the unclean spirit and says, "Be silent and come out of him." You see the parallel in how those our sentences are constructed, but here's the thing you miss. "Peace" and "be silent" is the same word in Greek. It's a command. Come out of there. It's a command that expects to be obeyed. And obey it does. So the wind calms, the sea the sea comes back to tranquil. And in that calm, then Jesus gives a second rebuke, except now he's not speaking to the storm outside. He's speaking to what's going on inside the disciples' hearts. And he says, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" Now, why are you afraid? Have you still no faith? There's a couple different ways to interpret this. One way is to think Jesus was reprimanding them for not having faith before. Like, you know, you've seen me heal the leprous, cast out unclean spirit. You've seen me work miracles before. Why are you afraid? Do you not have faith yet? But that to me would be like, why were you afraid? The fact that Jesus says, "Why are you afraid?" means that the disciples, even now, even with the, you know, the sea calmed, they're still afraid. But they're not afraid of the storm, they're not afraid of the water. I think if I were to put myself in the disciples' shoes, they're afraid of Jesus. They're afraid of this man whose power they don't even begin to grasp. They're afraid of this man. I mean, who is this, they ask, that he commands even the winds and the waves and they obey him? Who is this? And Jesus addresses his concern to them, his question. It's a response to their question, "Do you not care?" And he says basically, "Do you not trust? Do you not know my heart? Do you not know that I love you? Do you not trust? Have you still no faith?" You see, when we're in the storm, whatever the storm might be, our assumption tends to be that Jesus is not in the boat with us, or that he's asleep at the helm. He's not paying attention to what. And so we tend to invite Jesus into our chaos and our worry and our fear. And Rob and I were talking about this. He says, it's funny, Jesus, he doesn't step into the chaos and fear. Instead, he invites us to trust in his peace. He invites us to trust in his authority, his command. And so the disciples ask one another, "Who is this that even the winds and the waves obey him?" I'm going to go back to Mark 1 just for a moment. That same passage where Jesus cast out the unclean spirit, because you see the exact same response there. Can we go forward a couple slides? Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. One more. There we are. Because you see how those parallel? And they were filled with great awe, and they were all amazed. And they kept saying or asking one another, "Who is this? Or what is this? He commands the unclean spirits, and they obey him." See, the trick is that Jesus commands, and people obey. For Mark, the answer to the question, "Who is this?" is that Jesus is the one with authority. Authority like no one has ever seen in this world before. You see, what is the function of authority? I'm going to take you back to our eyes. What does authority do? Well, authority doesn't just tell us what we should do. Authority doesn't just give us directions. Actually, what authority does is it builds a shield between us and the storm. It creates what Ron Heifetz calls a holding environment. Authority keeps us from being flooded, swamped, paralyzed with fear. So a good doctor, Ron Heifetz says, doesn't just deliver the bombshell of the news and then walk out the door. A really good doctor with really good bedside manner, as they are delivering the news, they build a holding environment. They build up your trust. They tell you, here are the treatment options. Here are the things we can do. Here's the prognosis. And if at any point that doctor sees that the patient or the family is flooded and overwhelmed, then they stop and they build that holding environment back up before we give you more information. Because the key of authority is that it allows us to focus on the very next step we need to make. Jamel and I were talking about this, and she said, "You know, it reminds me of when we were in the earthquake in Haiti. And in an instant, 30 seconds, everything we'd built for the last 7 years destroyed." But she didn't have time to grieve in that moment because there were 10 people who were looking at her to make the decisions. And she didn't, you know, she didn't use this language at the time, but reflecting back on it, she says, I instinctively knew I had to shield people. I had to build a holding environment and block out all the things that we couldn't control or we couldn't do and just help people focus in on the next step and the next step and the next step and the next step until we got home. I like Ron's term, a holding environment, because that's what a boat is, right? A boat holds us. It carries us. It shields us from the storm. And if that's what authority does, then listen to this. Jesus is not just in the boat with us. Jesus is the boat. He is the one who carries us, who sustains us, who shields us from the storm. And the question is where do our eyes go? Do our eyes go to the storm? Do our eyes go to the wind? Do our eyes go to the wave? Or do our eyes stay fixed on his authority and his command? Who is this, the disciples ask? Well, it's the Son of God. Jesus is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He is the one who is able to command. And there's nothing that happens in our life or in the world that is beyond his authority to calm, to redeem, to renew, to heal. Do you not trust? Jesus asks. Because he cares about us. And praise God, he has the authority to make us whole if we follow his commands. Amen.